All right, welcome back to the show. Thank you so much for joining us. And as I mentioned in the opening market segment, we are lucky enough to be joined today by a guest who's been on the show multiple times. Always great to have him back, especially when crazy stuff is going on. And he's kind of like our doctor, if you will. We give this guy a call when we can't make sense of all the craziness going on in the world. But anyway, without further ado, Brent Johnson, thank you so much for joining us today. And lot of interesting stuff happening out there in the markets, isn't there, Brent?
Oh yeah, thanks for inviting me back. Always happy to come on and talk to you. And you know, I always say that regardless of what you want to say about this job, it's never boring. once in a while it is, and those times are, you know, kind of interesting in and of themselves because there's not much going on, and you know, if things are going good, it can be a little boring. But those times are very few and far between.
No.
More often, there's always something going on and you have to try to figure it out. And I'd say the last 2 weeks have been, you know, extremely interesting to say the least.
Yeah. Yeah. And for probably one of the reasons I was looking forward to this interview and thought it was really lucky timing to get you on here is just so many. I know that you've been focused. You've talked about it on our show before, focused not singularly or not myopically, but always keeping a watchful eye on the dollar. And that's been a unique story. And then watching this recent funding problem, and I'm going to operate off the assumption that a lot of our listeners probably aren't aware of it, but there's been some very odd things, and neither you and I spoke about this off the air. We're not experts on repo markets or anything of that nature, but you know, I guess know enough to be dangerous. But some very interesting things have been going on and in the repo markets. And for those of you that don't know, when we're talking about repo markets, we're basically talking about the interest rate that banks charge each other to loan money against other banks' assets. And we've seen a separation between that, what that costs banks or what they're paying for that, and the internal rate that the Fed pays on reserves or interest on excess reserves. Brent, did I botch that? Is that kind of go along with
no,
what you see?
You basically got it right. Essentially, what is happening is there's some short-term funding issues going on in the U.S. markets. So before I go into too much detail on that, let's first step back for a minute. To the point that you made, you know, at the beginning is, I keep a watchful eye on the dollar. And that's absolutely true. And for those who have heard me speak before, in the grand scheme of things, I think that all of the stuff that has happened over the last, call it 8 to 10 years with all the global central banks is going to end very, very badly. And at the end of the show, at the end of this big grand experiment, I think gold is going to be the last man standing. I've been saying that for 10 years, and I still feel like that is the case. Where I diverge from a lot of my friends in the gold world is that I think before that happens, I think the dollar is going to make a massive move higher. And I don't have time to go into all the reasons why that is, but suffice to say, it comes down to a supply and demand issue. The supply of dollars is not big enough to meet the overwhelming demand for dollars. And so that is something I've been talking about for a long time. And that indirectly plays into what has been happening in this short-term dollar funding markets over the last few weeks. So with that as a backdrop, there is a lot of the banks own a lot of treasuries. Okay, the primary dealer banks, the big banks, their job, one of their functions as a primary dealer institution is when the treasury issues bonds, they buy the bonds from the Treasury, and then they can either hold them or they can go and sell them to their clients. So that's the way the U.S. government funds itself, okay? Now, over the last several years, call it 3, 4, 5, 6 years, the U.S. Treasury has been issuing bonds with more short-dated maturities. In other words, they used to issue a lot of 10 to 30-year bonds, and in the last, I don't know, call it half a dozen years, the maturity at which they've been selling these bonds has dramatically shortened. So the most of the banks have the inventory of these treasury bonds that they have on their books are relatively short to medium term. They don't have a lot of 10 to 30 year bonds on their on their books. Now, this is going to get a little complicated, but stay with me here. The Treasury issues both bills, which are extremely liquid, short term, and then, you know, bonds and stuff, which are longer, you know, 5, 6, 7, 10, 30 years. As I said, they've been doing more and more short term. The banks have mostly on their balance sheet the bonds, which are, you know, short, medium term, but they don't have a lot of job is to buy new treasuries when the government issues new treasuries. So in the last month, once the debt ceiling was removed, and this is something that I have talked about, is that when the debt ceiling is removed, that's actually bullish for the dollar, not bearish for the dollar. And the reason it's bullish for the dollar is when the Treasury issues debt, they are going out into the market and trading their bonds for dollars. So they're giving the bonds away and they're taking the dollars in. So when you hit the debt ceiling and you can't issue bonds anymore, that means the biggest buyer in the world is not out there buying dollars. But now that the debt ceiling was removed, they're able to go out there, issue those bonds, and buy dollars. The problem, going back to my very original thing about talking about supply and demand, the government is no longer doing QE. They're not printing dollars, and they have until just the last 6 to 9 months been raising interest rates, which has been creating a shortage of dollars in the world. So now it all kind of hits here in September when the government comes back out and starts buying dollars with their treasury bonds. And these banks, who already are chock full of bonds, have to go out and buy those treasury bonds. And they don't have enough cash, ready cash to do. They have enough assets, and they can typically finance those assets by placing those assets at the Fed or, you know, with other member banks, or go to the repo market. The repo market is basically a private market. It's not the government market. You can go out to a hedge fund or a big finance asset manager or some other big banks, and they will loan you cash in order to hold onto your bonds for a short period of time. Okay?
Yeah.
So what has been happening is in that private market, not the federal funds rate, not the interest on excess reserves that the Fed will pay the banks, to give them that collateral, is that in the private market to do these short-term loans has been going higher and higher. In other words, the Fed typically controls the very short-term interest rates, but the market is pricing short-term interest rates higher than the Fed is. And as we got into this cash crunch, for lack of a better word, or dollar shortage, and people were having trouble just short-term financing, the rate at which the repo market, the private market, was pricing short-term interest rates dramatically diverged from the Fed, the short-term interest rates. And you saw repo rates spike, anywhere from 2 to 4, 3 to 4%, and in some cases, 7 or 8%. Now, it's more of a short-term funding thing than it is an overall problem. But, you know, I was talking to some people yesterday, and there was this big discussion. The people that work in the weeds of repo, they say this is not a problem. All you have to do is the Fed steps in, does very short-term repo of the repo. So that when the Fed does repo for the private market repo, it's called reverse repo. So I'm sorry that this is very confusing, but they are right. There is a very easy short-term fix for this, and that is that the Fed steps in, provides short-term liquidity, and then when the liquidity comes back, they swap it back, and everything's fine. So the people deep in the weeds of repo say this isn't a problem. That's what repo is there for. It can be solved very quickly, and they're absolutely right. But it's also a little bit like jumping out of the airplane with the parachute on, and you pull the ripcord, and the parachute doesn't open. And the guy that says, well, it's a very simple problem. You know, we just have to fix the ripcord. Well, that's true, but they're missing the overall problem that you're plummeting towards the earth, right? So, you know, they are technically correct that fixing the ripcord can be done relatively easily. The problem is that you're falling towards the earth at terminal velocity, right?
Right.
So that's kind of what's going on. There is a very easy short-term fix, but it doesn't fix the underlying bigger problem of the dollar shortage. So I don't know if that helps or not. It may have confused it more than it helped it, but essentially that is what's going on.
Well, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I think the reason that guys like you or I, you know, whoever that do this for a living, that we're paying attention to these things is because we're, you know, maybe it's, again, maybe there is some confirmation bias in play. But one of the reasons that I pay attention to these things is because when you see the unprecedented level of monetary experimentation done by central banks over the last decade, you're kind of looking back and watching for when those gears start to grind, right? When you start seeing a breakdown in the mechanisms that have really been driving things. And as I looked over this situation and was kind of doing my own homework, getting ready for this interview, I kept looking over this scenario and kept going back through it and reading as much as I get my hands on. And I kind of came to the conclusion, and feel free to let me know if I'm wrong, but this sort of points to me like a lack of collateral. Is that what you think is causing this? Is there a lack of good collateral out there that so many guys have been warning about for a long period of time? And then if that is the case, Brent, how in the world can there be a lack of collateral, i.e. good government bonds, which is probably the, you know, the most often used asset for collateral in these lending scenarios that we're talking about? How in the world is that possible when the world is swimming in record amounts of debt?
Well, so I would say that you're not wrong. You are right. They do talk a lot about the lack of collateral, and this goes back to the fact that the Fed has been reducing the balance sheet for the last 2 years now, three years now. I don't know the exact time frame, and you know they've been reducing the reserves, right? And so as they do that, as they shrink their balance sheet, the reserves in the banking system shrink, and then therefore that leads to a lack of collateral, and that goes back to the lack of supply. I mean, here's the thing: in a debt-based monetary system, in many ways, debt equals money. So if you start deleveraging the collateral, you also start deleveraging the money supply.
Right.
And that goes back to my argument that there is a lack of dollars out there. If you decrease, so if you think about money being loaned into existence, somebody puts $100 in the bank keeps 10 or 15 and they loan out 85 or 90. And then the people that got the loans, they go put that money, they go spend it on a car. And the guy that owns the car shop, he puts that money in the bank. The bank keeps 15 of it and they loan out 85. So you get this money multiplier effect in a debt-based monetary system. That's how the money system grows. The problem is when somebody defaults or when you start deleveraging, then all those, you know, it creates a cascade effect back the other way. And so in a debt-based monetary system, it always has to be expanding. If it ever expands or contracts, you get the bust, right?
Yep.
And so that's the argument that everybody's been saying, that the Fed cannot normalize. They can't keep reducing their balance sheet. This is all going to end very badly. And listen, they're absolutely right. The question is, what are the knock-on effects of that? Not just in the U.S., but around the world. And what happens, how long does it take and what happens in the meantime? You know, again, this is all going to end really, really badly. It's basically a mathematical certainty. But the timing of which that end comes is very much up for question.
Yeah. Yeah. And well, I mean, that's the $64,000 question. I don't think either you or I would pretend to know that, you know, when that's coming. The one thing that did surprise me about this, Brent, and I don't know what you make of it, if anything at all, is that I kept looking at this issue. I'm assuming you're on the same side of this as I am. And maybe that's wrong of me to assume that. But I thought this was something to pay attention to. Yet I was not at all buying the Chicken Littles out there that were, you know, oh, this is the beginning. You know, here it comes. This is the start. This looked to me like a hiccup in the transmission system and in the global financial system. But one one of the reasons why I thought that is because I didn't see a corresponding spike in the dollar. Did you notice
right.
that? Is that?
Yeah. And so, you know, the argument has been put out there that because the dollar is not spiking, that this is an internal U.S. problem and not an external to the U.S. problem. And listen, there's some truth to that. And I've always said it's not that the U.S. doesn't have problems. We have an enormous amount of problems. But the idea that the rest of the world does not, and we are the only ones that are going to suffer from this problem, I think is incredibly myopic. And you have to understand, part of the reason that, you know, the Fed has reduced interest rates, part of the reason that Mario Draghi went out with a bang, went completely dovish, part of the reason that China has decreased their required reserve ratio and flooded their market with liquidity is because of the dollar strength, because of the lack of dollars.
Right.
The strong dollar, now the dollar has not broken out, but it's remained pretty strong all year. It's up, I don't know, 3, 4, 5% for the year. And despite all the things that have been thrown at it, it hasn't fallen. So to the people that say it hasn't spiked and it hasn't broken out, they're absolutely correct. Now, I thought it would have happened by now, and it hasn't. But the fact that everything has been thrown at it, and I got a whole list of things, but that it hasn't fallen is very telling. And so, you know, again, I think a lot of times people get cause and effect messed up when we're talking about the dollar and we're talking about the Fed. A lot of people will say the dollar is going to fall, which will be the effect from the Fed, which is going to ease. That's the cause. So the cause is, they say the cause is the Fed easing, and the effect will be that the dollar falls. The reality is that's completely backwards.
Yep.
The cause is the dollar getting stronger, and the effect is that the Fed has to react to it. So if you think that the dollar is going to continually, or if you think they're going to do QE4, QE5, QE6, QE7, then that means that you think that despite QE4, QE5, and QE6, the only reason they'd have to do QE7 is if the dollar wasn't falling. So, you know, it's the monetary policy is the reaction to the market. The market is sending the dollar higher. And here's what I think is really interesting right now, Zach, is that let's call it the last 12 to 18 to 24 months. Everybody's thesis from the last, you know, that period, 12 to 24 months, is still somewhat intact, right?
Yeah.
Dollar bulls. Like me, you know, the dollar keeps inching up. It hasn't fallen despite everything. And so we kind of feel like our view is still holding. The dollar bears, like Luke and some of the other people, they say, yeah, but you know what? The Fed has had to turn around. They're starting to implement these policies. So they feel like they're still right, even though the dollar hasn't fallen. The equity bulls, like me, who said, you know, the dollar is going to get stronger and it's going to pull capital flows in and it's going to push stocks higher on a relative basis just because it's better than everything else. You know, stocks are within 1 or 2% of their all-time highs. So we kind of feel like, you know, we've been okay. But the stock bulls or bears, you know, we had that huge sell-off in Q4, and now this year so far they've reduced rates 2 times in order to support the market. So the stock bears feel like they're right in the game still. You know, a year ago, a lot of the bond bulls weren't feeling so good because yields had spiked, but now they're feeling like geniuses because yields have dropped. So, you know, I feel like there's all these different markets are kind of just right on a knife's edge and they can go either way. So it's just really interesting that everybody's kind of still in the game. Now, you know, I'm not certain of anything. I have a high conviction level that I think I'm going to be right, but you know, I can be wrong. I've been wrong before many times and I will be wrong again many times in the future. I think the trick in this business is that you know you're going to be wrong at some point. The trick is not to lose too much when you're wrong. Make a decent amount or actually a good amount when you're right. And then when you get it wrong, hopefully you don't lose too much. Because, you know, this is a business. You're going to be wrong. There's no way you're always going to get it right. So I think I just think it's extremely interesting. And, you know, I love it right now.
Yeah.
I don't know if you saw it, but, you know, this legendary investor, T. Boone Pickens, passed away about a week ago.
Yep.
And I saw just yesterday that, I don't know if it was one of his family members or colleagues or somebody, posted a letter that he wrote before he passed away. And it was a great, if you haven't seen, I recommend everybody go to Google or Twitter or wherever it is and find this letter that T. Boone Pickens wrote. You know, he talked about his life as an investor, and my favorite line in the whole thing was, you know, at some point you got to take a shot. You know, you can't be afraid to take a shot. And, you know, that's kind of how I feel like our business is. You know, we're kind of at a momentous time in history, I really feel. And I feel like you have a viewpoint. And, you know, if you have a strong conviction, you have to be willing to take the shot. And that means you might miss, right? But, you know, somebody's got to take the shot. And I just loved that line because I kind of feel that's where we are right now. I mean, I feel like I have a certain point of view and I'm taking a shot. And, you know, if I get it wrong, if I miss the shot, then I'll have to regroup and, you know, we'll work towards taking another shot. But right now, I think that's kind of, I don't think this is a market where you can just kind of, you know, sit back and not pay attention. I think it's something that you really have to kind of be on your toes about.
Yeah, no, I agree with you 100%. You're going to be wrong. Part of the game. It's why I love the old Twitter joke, right? It's you can't find, you know, you got all these immaculate traders is what I call them, these immaculate records. You know, they always sell at the top. They always buy at the bottom.
Yep.
And I always laugh because I just sit there and I go, there's a guy that doesn't manage money on a professional basis because that's just,
yeah, right. Exactly.
It's not the way it goes. Exactly. I had one recently where I was on Tobias Carlyle's podcast and I was saying that a stock that we liked that we were watching was Tailored Brands, thought it was really undervalued. We thought management was going to do A, B, and C, and if they did that, we thought it was going to be a great deal. Now, we got the stock at a very low price, so our entry cost was low. Management came out, did exactly what we thought they should do. Stock dropped 30%. And you don't need to look around for humbling experiences in this business because you're going to find them all the time. But that was my most recent reminder that, hey, you know, yep, you can have it all right, and the price action just goes against you. It's just part of the game.
Right.
But anyway,
let me give you an example because I think this demonstrates it pretty well. I think 15 or 16 months ago, it was early spring of 2018, bonds made a really big move higher. And, you know, I thought it was overdone and we sold a large portion of our fixed income. And over the subsequent 9 months, we looked really, really smart because yields went from, I don't know, 2% to 3% on the 10-year or something like that,
yep,
right?
Yep.
And so, you know, and we allocated that money from stocks into, we left some in cash and we started in the second half of the year, we started legging into more equities between September and December. Okay. And so, you know, as we did that and the market started selling off in October, November, December, we were putting money to work at increasingly lower prices in equities. And that paid off really well for us in early 2019. But what we got wrong, and I fully admit that I got this wrong, was the hard reversal in bonds, right? And
yeah,
so I got that wrong, but it didn't cost me anything because I was just out of the trade, so it was an opportunity cost. I didn't lose money as a result of it, but the equities that we allocated to did even better than the bonds. So, you know, that was a case where we got it wrong, but it didn't cost us a lot other
right
than maybe an opportunity cost. So, you know, I think that, and that's a good, oh, the other thing, I'll use gold as an example. Everybody knows I talk about gold. You know, I own gold. I think everybody should own gold. I didn't think it was going to break out the way it has this year, and I got it wrong. But you know what? It didn't cost me anything because I already own it. Now,
right,
could I have made more if I put more into gold or if I bought something? Yeah, sure. But, you know, again, there's no guarantee that gold stays at these prices. I still believe, you know, it may pull back here in the fourth quarter. But if I'm wrong, it's okay. We already own gold. So I think that, again, I think everybody needs to kind of realize that you're going to get it wrong. The trick is to, you know, try to get it right more often than you get it wrong. And hopefully your assets compound over time.
Yeah. Hey, from your lips to God's ears, man. Okay. So moving on a little bit, got through that esoteric conversation about IOER and Fed funds rate and all that fun stuff that I'm sure the home gamers listening on the radio are just riveted.
Yep.
but moving over to China, and again, full caveat, I know you'd probably say the exact same thing. I'm not a Chinese expert by any stretch of the imagination. My interest in this subject is 100% based in the fact that it is now the world's second largest economy, not to mention this, you know, Frankenstein like debt experiment that they're running across their entire economy. But China's starting to show some signs of stress. I was watching some video last night that came out where pensioners, and I can't remember what the province was, I should have written it down, but pensioners were picketing the local government offices because the pension checks hadn't come through. They've had to shut down or take over some banks recently. What do you see going on in China? And is there, you know, how do you think that that's a bellwether? And how much does this play into your strong dollar thesis and kind of give us the lay of the land and what you see going on and the reason why, or possibly why not, why this would be an important or a not important development in the world today.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's hugely important for no other reason that it's either the first or the second biggest client to the rest of the world, right?
Right.
It's the biggest trading partner for the United States. It's the biggest trading partner with Europe. It's the biggest trading partner with much of the rest of Asia. It's a huge, huge market. So if they go into a recession or if their currency peg breaks or if they have a hard landing, so to speak, it has enormous implications for the rest of the world. So from that perspective, yes, I absolutely think it's very important. And it's actually a big part of my strong dollar thing because I think things in China are much worse than even many of the bears think that they are. I think that their growth is lower than they say it is. I think that their bad loans on their banks' balance sheets are even worse than they say they are. I think that their economy is slowing at a faster rate than even they admit that it is. And so I think that there will ultimately be a hard landing in China. And I think that that has enormous implications for the rest of the world, because if that happens, if their economy slows too much, and, you know, you got to remember that China gets a lot of their funding still in dollars.
Yep.
And they have these huge loans. Dollars are no longer going in, or the foreign direct investment is falling. Their current account surplus is going from positive to negative. And like any debt-based monetary system, you need continual inflows to keep it going. And I think China's inflows are dramatically slowing. And I think that they will have the hard landing. When that happens, I think the dollar goes much higher. When the dollar goes much higher, it has knock-on effects for places that export commodities like Australia and Canada. Not only is it bad for the commodities, but they sell those commodities into China, right? And now China can't buy them. So you get this, you get these enormous knock-on effects, not to mention that if the dollar goes much higher, the emerging markets have about $5 or $6 trillion of U.S. dollar debt. And the other international entities have another $6 or $7 trillion of U.S. dollar debt. So, you know, just servicing that dollar debt on an annual basis is a huge burden on these international entities. And as the dollar goes higher, it makes it even more so. So it's kind of this knock-on ratchet effect where the strong dollar causes all this chaos. The chaos leads to fund flows coming back to the dollar, which makes even more strong, even more strength in the dollar, which causes even more problems. And you're starting to see that show up. It still hasn't happened in spades. I think that is going to ramp up over the next 12 to 18 months.
Yeah, no, I see it as much the same. The other interesting thing to me about China, and I've had Luke on the, and every time we talk to you doesn't mean we have to talk about Luke. I realize you guys, you both probably get tired of being linked to each other. Yeah. and is as partial as I am to a lot of his arguments, because I do think, at the end of all this, I see a scenario much like he's painting, or much like he's suggesting. I see that playing out. I mean, I just think the dollar will go the way of all fiat currency. My feeling is we're probably closer to that than most people realize. But I very much agree with you, just due to structure and fund flows. The dollar losing 20% of its value is a vacation for the rest of the world's economies. The dollar surging the dollar surging in value is the thing that's going to blow everything up. And so, you know, it makes sense to me that that dollar strength would come first. Now, if we pivot a little bit, and it's something that, again, I see very similar to you. And I think I've got some other fears or reservations that maybe you don't have, which is that correlating, you know, you say strong dollar and rising equities, people kind of look at you like you're growing a third eye out of the middle of your forehead.
Yeah,
you
know? I'm used to it.
And I'm with you, just because I think, especially as it relates to, not as highly valued dividend payers and things like that. You know, very durable U.S. centric type stocks that are paying dividends. Specifically, maybe it'll be broader than that. I can see a strong dollar correlating with that bid, because where else are correlating with those stocks being bid up? Because if we do experience a dollar crunch, that's one of the few investments in the world that will actually pay you a flow of dollars, right? It's one
exactly. And, exactly. And, 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 you know, I started using the example a year or so ago that, you know, if I was a European pension fund manager and I was looking at the world and where I could allocate, where would I choose? And I said I would rather own Philip Morris that trades in the U.S., has huge liquidity and pays a 4% dividend and is denominated in dollars. I would rather buy that than buy an Italian corporate that, you know, hasn't seen any growth for several years and is tied to the euro. And, you know, two, maybe 3 weeks ago now, you saw the Central Bank of Norway recommend to the Sovereign Wealth Fund of Norway that they decrease their allocation of equities in Europe and allocate those further to the United States. Now, that doesn't mean that the floodgates are opening, but that does kind of confirm that some very, very big entities are considering doing things like this. And I think that that will pick up and that will increase. You know, again, it doesn't mean that it's all going to happen at once. And it doesn't mean that, you know, stocks are going to go up in a very smooth and easy ride. I don't think that at all. I think it's going to be, I've said this several times, and I think people forget when I say this part of it, and they just hear me say stocks higher, and therefore they think that I'm this, you know, Pollyanna equity bull. But, you know, I'm going to say this again. It's going to be really, really terrifying. There's going to be moments where it's scary, scary, scary. And it's going to feel like, you know, the bottom is going to fall out. You know, we had that last fourth quarter, but then, you know, it turned around relatively quickly. I don't think that that's going to go away. I think ultimately 2-3 years from now, probably maybe not 3 years, maybe 2 years from now, equities are dramatically higher. But I think there are going to be moments of pure terror along this path. And, you know, I wish that wasn't the case, but I think it is.
Okay, so something I struggle with, because I'm a little bit torn. I definitely am leaning to your side of it, just because and you can feel free to correct me if I'm wrong, but yeah. I sit back and I look at the whole scenario and I go, look, I can disagree with the valuations. I can disagree with the expectations that are being placed on the, you know, on the future earnings of a lot of these companies. But at the end of the day, that hasn't been what's been driving equity markets for a decade now. And until I see the mechanism break that's been driving equity markets, it's really hard to get all bared up. And that mechanism being, you know, central banks, you know, infusing capital at even the slightest disruption. Does that kind of go along with how you see it?
Yeah. So let me get. I'm going to give you a very brief synopsis of my theory, what's going to happen, and I'm going to tell you why it jives with what you just said. And to be clear, my theory is not one based on valuation or earnings growth or breakaway, you know, good times in the United States. Ultimately, my argument comes down to the TINA argument. There is no alternative, and I'm going to tell you right up front, the TINA argument is an absolutely horrible theory, except for there is no alternative to there is no alternative theory.
Right.
What I mean by where else are you going to go? Let's say you have big capital that you need to allocate. Are you going to go to Europe, where they have had zero economic growth for years and are probably headed into, you know, further recession, if not depression, or, you know, where they have, you know, a number breakaway movements, which could lead to the dissolution of the euro? Are you going to go to international bonds, where the majority of the high-rated international bonds are now negative yielding? I think it's like $15 trillion worth of negative yielding international bonds. Is that where all this money is going to go to? Is it going to go to China, where you can't get it back out and where everybody knows that their statistics are heavily manipulated? Now, it doesn't mean that China is the only place that does that, but to think that China doesn't manipulate their statistics, I think, would be inadvisable. Are they going to go to emerging markets that has $5 to $6 trillion of U.S. dollar debt when the dollar's strengthening? Do you think breakaway growth is happening in these emerging markets, that that's where you're going to take all of your capital from Europe and place it in the emerging markets? I just don't see it. I mean, I think when you look around, as dire as it may be, when you analyze the U.S. in a vacuum, I don't know where else you go. And I think that was what will end up happening. Again, I don't necessarily think it should happen this way. I don't necessarily think it's fair. I don't necessarily think we deserve the capital flows. I just think we're going to get them. And I need to place my capital in front of where the flows are going. And so that's kind of how I see it.
No, and that's what drew me to your argument at the first time I heard it was, and we've spoken about this before, but it's so easy. A mutual friend of ours, Chase Taylor, refers to them as financial justice warriors. And I made a joke the other day that my name's Zach and I'm a recovering financial justice warrior.
Right.
That transition was very hard for me to make. You know, I was used to looking at equity markets in such a way that I got to, you know, pull out my Buffett and Munger hat and I got to value these things and look at these things. But we also have to acknowledge and accept that the world has changed. And if you don't believe that, then look at the fact that economic growth here in the United States over the last 10 years, real economic growth, is the slowest growing decade in history, including the Great Depression, yet equity markets tripled over the same period of time. Right?
Yep, exactly.
So something else is afoot. And until that mechanism breaks down, you got to be conscious of it. Now, here's the question I want to ask you, and I think it's very prescient that you use the term ripcord. I know that you're also conscious of valuations. At what point, if things start going the other way, what signs would you see that would lead you to believe, wait a second, because I know you're not that rigid in your thought where you're going to go down with the ship. When do you pull the ripcord and go, okay, wait a second, I think I've got this set up right? Because, you know, from my perspective, Brent, I'll believe it if I see it. If Luke's situation plays out correct, Luke's a smarter guy than I am, I'll believe it when I see it. I just cannot envision a world where a falling dollar leads to the next catastrophe. I just can't see that. If it happens, I'll adjust. But what if the strong dollar scenario, because I just, like I said, I just can't see that not happening. So the strong dollar scenario plays out, that aspect of it continues, but equities have a more traditional response. Maybe markets start plunging.
Yeah.
At what point do you pull the ripcord and rethink that and maybe backtrack on that? Where's that break point to you?
So that's a good question. I think it depends on several. There's no one thing, right? And it's not no one absolute level. And it kind of depends on what's happening in other places and why is it that equities are falling. And if the dollar, here's the thing, it's hard to just focus on one asset class. I manage customized portfolios for individuals, and then in addition to that, we have set up a special purpose vehicle. It's a private fund that will play the knock-on effects of a strong dollar. And we think that when that happens, the returns are asymmetric. So let's pretend that the dollar does get a lot stronger. It causes all kind of chaos around the world, and U.S. equities fall, right?
Yep.
If U.S. equities fall, we already have hedges against our U.S. equities. Again, I think equities go much higher over the next couple of years, but I think it's very possible we have a repeat performance in Q4 this year of what we had Q4 last year.
Yeah.
So I'm not against having some short-term tactical positions that protect, right? And then we have some short-term fixed income, and we have a lot of cash. And so if we have another, let's say we have another Q4 this year, like we had Q4 last year, my hedges will help me. The knock-on effects in the special purpose vehicle will really help me as the dollar gets stronger. And so maybe we don't make any money in the fourth quarter, right? The thing is that we made really good money in Q1 and Q2 this year by being long equities. So we're lucky that we don't have to be very aggressive right now in the third and fourth quarter because we were aggressive back in January and February when nobody else was. Now, if we go back, let's say we go back to the lows of where we were last December and we break through there, right? Maybe at that technical level, maybe it's good to just stand by and let things play out for the next and just kind of see where everything goes from there, right?
Yeah.
So I don't really have and it depends on what they do as a reaction, right? It depends on what is the effect of that happening. What's the response from the different central banks? Remember, it's not just dependent on the Fed. We got to talk about the ECB, you got to talk about the Bank of Japan, you got to talk about the Bank of China, the Canadian Central Bank, all of these different central banks, will be reacting. And, you know, if we go into a real tailspin, our special purpose vehicle, we believe, will do extremely well. And the trades we're doing in that vehicle are so asymmetric that if you get it right, you don't make a little bit of money. If you get it right, you make a lot of money. And if you get it wrong, you don't lose that much. So, you know, I think it all depends on, you know, how you have your overall portfolio set up. One thing people need to remember is that when you go and you look at your portfolio or you visit with your financial advisor, you know, the first question you should always ask is, where are we making money? And hopefully there's some answers where you're actually making money, right?
Yes.
The second question you should always ask is, where are we losing money? And if the answer is nowhere, we're not losing money anywhere, then you need to have a very serious third question, because if you're not losing money anywhere, then you're not diversified. So, you know, and it's really hard for people to understand that. Nobody wants to lose money in any part of their portfolio, right?
Yep.
But if you're not losing somewhere, then, you know, you're basically doing one trade and it's all going in one direction, and it feels really good when you're going up and it feels really bad when you're going down. So I think, you know, you need to have a number of different plays in your portfolio to be ready for all different scenarios. And then I think you need to have, you know, not only the ability to be nimble in your account, but you need to have the ability to be nimble in your in your emotions. You know, I have very strong convictions, right? And I think you have to have a strong conviction in order to kind of get where you're going. But you also have to have the time where you have to at some point admit you were wrong. And, you know, I have to do that from time to time. And I don't like it. I don't like being wrong, right? But Sometimes you just have to do it.
Well, and then the quicker, the other thing you learn too, and I know you know this, is that, you know, I'm honestly looking on a constant basis for where I'm wrong more ardently than I'm looking for where I'm right, right? Where you're right is going to take care of itself. Where you're wrong is where, you know, that's where the ugly things happen. I'm very concerned on a valuation basis. And this is something I was talking again to Tobias Carlisle last time we had him on the show, and this was the next thing I was going to bring up. So if you have something to add to that, you know, before you answer that, feel free. But I think, and I know you've noticed this, but I think, and we've been talking about this for about a month now, but it looks to me like this transition from these high-flying, you know, ridiculously valued, so many of these companies, ridiculously valued companies, this kind of modern tech bubble, if you will, it looks to me like assets are starting to flow into these types of stocks that you and I spoke about the first time that we had a conversation in relationship to the milkshake theory. Do you think we're seeing, I'm sitting here looking at my screen right now, I've got Netflix down to 260. I don't know when the last time it was down that far. You know, the thing topped out at like 440, I want to say. The starch is starting to come out of these names, and I'm watching these companies, Philip Morris being one that we've held for a while, long time.
Yep.
You know, you've brought that up before. But these types of companies catching a bid, do you think this transition's starting to happen? Are we starting to see capital flows coming our way?
You know, I think we are seeing capital flows. I'm not yet convinced that the run in growth is over, though. I think what's predominantly going to happen is as capital comes to the U.S., I think it's going to go into the big names first and then, you know, work its way down into the smaller markets. So it's something certainly to keep an eye on. I'm not saying that you're wrong by any means, but we've seen a number of these times over the last 3 or 4 years where the bloom starts to come off the rose of these high-flying, you know, tech stocks, only to see 2 weeks later it all reversed and it's right back where it started, right?
Yeah.
So I think it's probably a little bit too early to make that call, but it's certainly something to be paying attention to.
Well, and it's just been it's felt like a respite from the, you know, from the executioner's axe, if you will. I just finally watching some capital flows into these names and not just watching this stuff just float with no constraint, you know, and I I don't know how you feel. Obviously, you can take bets here or there, but a lot of that stuff. We had this conversation with a lot of our clients, and I promise to the listeners out there that you and I did not discuss this before we got on the air, but you were bringing up, look, it's the way you set up the portfolio. One of our segments that we did before we had you on where I was talking about, look, it's not just what you buy. It's also the structure of your portfolio, that it's got to be built for all seasons. You got to have things that are losing some money, and that's tough for people to understand. But when we're managing retirement assets, you're managing them on a little bit different level than I am, obviously. But when we're managing retirement assets, it's not about beating the S&P 500 every year, because that's typically not the way it's going to roll. You know, what we're looking for is a better end result, a better financing of retirement. And a lot of times, like you alluded to, and I think it's something that's horrifically misunderstood and not talked enough, but about enough, especially in retail circles, that if we're going to outperform over the long run, you must accept the fact that we're going to underperform over different periods in between, right?
Yeah, exactly. Just, it's really hard. Setting expectations up front and educating clients on what to expect, I think, is one of the most underappreciated portions of this business.
Yeah.
And I say that from an advisor side, but I also I think it's extremely important from a customer side. If you're out there and you're meeting with your financial advisor or you're meeting with potential investment advisors, I think you need to make sure that you're on the same page as your advisor as far as what the expectations are. Because if the expectations are not on the same page, you're going to have a horrible experience.
That's right. Yeah, regardless of what kind of portfolio you're running. And then you've also got to be liquid. You know, we kind of have a unique situation. And I don't know if this is good or bad, but last year was actually a pretty decent year for us. I mean, I think we were up 0.5% or 1% in our actively managed portfolio. Knock on effect, though, you know, this year we've underperformed by a wide margin. I mean, we're not down, thank God. But, you know, I think we're up 4 or 5% or something like that year to date. Market's racing the top. The other thing we've been telling our clients is, look, guys, you got to look at performance over long-term intervals, right? It's not just over a six-month period of time. And, you know, I'm always reminded of The Big Short. You know, Michael Burry's story, I think his fund was down 47% at one point.
Yeah,
You know, and it's just the law of nature, right? Another guy I remember reading about, Mark Hart, when he made his big score in the uranium stocks, he was down 50% the year prior and then was up 350 the next year.
Yeah. I mean, like I said, it's a delicate balance. You have to have the courage of your convictions to stay the trade when it goes against you, but then you also have to be flexible enough to admit when you're wrong. And it's not easy, you know. It's not. I'm not sitting here saying that it's as easy as that, because it's not. And so, you know, I guess that's where judgment comes in, right?
Yeah.
I think it's Jim Rogers is famous of saying you can use Google for a lot of things, but you can't use Google to. You can't use Google for judgment.
Yeah.
You know, at the end of the day, you got to make that judgment yourself. And, you know, I don't have a perfect answer for that. Some people are better at it than others.
Yeah. Well, now I'd be remiss if I had you on and didn't ask you about these two things. So, A, what is your outlook on treasuries, and do they play into your portfolios that you're using right now? What is your outlook, and what is your take on where we're at with treasuries right now?
So I'm probably in the minority in this, I think I don't really think about treasuries on an absolute level. I think about them relative to everybody else.
Okay.
Relative to all other treasuries in the world, I am bullish U.S. treasuries. In and of themselves on an absolute basis, I'm probably not as bullish treasuries as a lot of my friends are. I have a lot of friends who are, you know, extreme dollar bulls, and listen, they've had an amazing call over the last, call it 9 months, and have made a lot of money on rates reversing and falling. Completely understand their arguments. I've talked to a number of people who even argue that rates are going to go much lower than they already are, and that's fine. I get it. And if that happens, I will not be shocked. I personally do not think that rates in the U.S. are going to go to zero, or I don't think they're going to go negative in the U.S. If they continue to fall, that will not shock me. But I do not at this point think that they're going to go negative. I think what we're going to see in, you know, international bonds, I think we will see in the short term or at some point over the next year, it's possible that they do go even more negative. But I think over the next 12 to 18 months, we're going to start to see some of these yields outside the United States rise, not because of inflation and because things are getting better, but because of counterparty concerns. And if yields outside the U.S. start to rise, then that somewhat relieves pressure on U.S. yields to go lower. Now, it could be that as those yields rise and people sell those bonds and the capital comes to the U.S., it also goes into bonds and stocks, and that pushes U.S. bond prices higher, so the yield comes down. But it also, that flow of capital coming in from overseas and from, let's call it, foreign treasuries coming under credit concerns, that can almost act like an artificial QE of injecting capital into the U.S. market, which could be able to give the Feds a little bit of room to maneuver and not have to pull rates lower. So, you know, I'm watching it very closely. Again, I have some exposure to treasuries. I don't have a huge exposure to treasuries. If yields go lower because price is going higher, it's not going to hurt me at all. But it won't help me, but it won't hurt me at all either. And in fact, if that happens, and the U.S. yields go lower, that's going to mean that things are going pretty bad around the world, and the knock-on effects of in our asymmetric fund should help us a lot.
Yeah. Okay. Now I got to wrap a couple of these off quick because I want to get you. I know you're a busy guy, but one thing that caught me off guard. I want to get your take on this. Brent, I kind of quit paying attention to it because I thought it was sort of a foregone conclusion month and a half ago. There was a lot of talk about an earnings recession. Its earnings season started off pretty good for this last quarter. But then as the last stocks trickled in, the last 10 Qs and came across the deal, and we're tallying it all up here. We get to the end of the quarter, and in fact, we've now got two quarters of negative earnings. What do you make of that? Does that play into your thesis at all? And there's so much talk and consternation about a recession. I'm sort of on the fence on this one, just because I think it's going to be, from what I see right now, I think it's going to be tough for us to go into recession, because if we do, I just keep thinking that, you know, the world itself has to keep deteriorating, and the capital flows into the United States should offset a lot of that, you know, a lot of that stuff as it relates to our economy. But we do have a yield curve inversion. We do have a lot of leading indicators pointed in the wrong direction, some of them, you know, showing weakness that we haven't seen in 9-10 years. We've now got two quarters of declining earnings. Where are you at on the recession read right now? And does the other thing I've thought a lot about is, does a recession, you know, obviously it depends on the severity of a recession, but even if you had a mild to moderate recession, does that necessarily throw off your higher equities call?
No, you know, and it doesn't.
Right.
And I'll tell you why. Again, this is, you got to understand, I'm happy to talk about earnings. I'm happy to talk about valuations, but to a certain extent, I just don't think it matters. Now, yeah, it eventually will. Again, if you use Graham and Dodd's security analysis and you buy deep out of the, you know, value, deep out of the money calls, or you're buying deep value assets that are trading below intrinsic value, and you buy those assets and you hold, you will eventually make money. That is, you know, that is a sure thing. But you might have to wait a very long time to be able to buy them at those low valuations. And then you may have to hold for a very long time before, you know, it reverts to its historical mean and goes above, you know, the its traditional valuation. So I'm this is by no means, you know, discrediting, you know, the Graham and Dodd deep value. That's probably one of the best ways to manage money. I just don't think it applies right now. And not that it shouldn't apply right now. I just don't think it does. So earnings recession is indicative to me that the whole world is slowing down, right? But you got to understand, my whole theory is based on the whole world slowing down. My theory, the biggest challenge in my theory is everything gets better.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Going into a recession doesn't really, you know, send negative shockwaves through my body. Now, but let's go back to the recession for a second. You know, you talk about the slowing down of earnings, and you talk about the yield curve inversion. Okay. So yes, the yield curve is inverted, and everybody says that's a sure sign of a recession, and it absolutely is. It almost always leads to a recession. But the flip side of it is, or that's slide one. And what I say is, they never tell you about slide two, and they never tell you about slide three.
Right.
Because on slide one, it says yield curve inversion, recession. True. Slide two tells you that recession usually doesn't come for 18 to 24 months. Okay, so yield curve inverted sometime in the last 6 months. If we hold historical norms, we got another year, 18 months before the recession comes. Okay, so that's slide two. So even though it happened, it doesn't mean it's imminent. Could be, but it doesn't necessarily mean it is. And then they almost never tell you slide three, which is typically when a yield curve inverts and it takes 18 to 24 months to go into a recession, is that the equities are almost always positive during that 18 to 24 months.
Yep.
So, you know, I think that's where we're at. I mean, again, this is not a Pollyanna view that things are getting better and we've got this, you know, great future ahead of us. This is going to be really, really bad. It's going to end in a, you know, absolute disaster. I just think before it's all said and done that U.S. equities are going higher.
Yeah, no, and like I said, especially the stocks out there in the equities that do present some value, especially some income flow, you know, like we've talked about since the first time we talked, if the world is short dollars, and I think all you have to do is look at the construction or the setup of foreign debt around the world, it's pretty hard to make the argument that it's not. Some do. But, you know, if you, again, getting back into a diversified portfolio, If the one thing that is the world is really short of is U.S. dollars, then it's hard to imagine a scenario where the capital seeking those U.S. dollars does not find these dividend paying stocks, these stocks that, you know, are typically pretty anti-cyclical,
right,
that, you know, that aren't getting blown out in a recession. And I think one of the worst things people do, and you can feel free to disagree with me if you'd like to, but they use the litmus test of 08, 09. And I sit there and I go, well, hold on. You know, 08, 09 is certainly possible, but that was a liquidity crunch. You know, those stocks, you know, their losses, most of them were not indicative of the underlying health of the economy. It was just, you know, they were getting thrown overboard because people needed dollars, right? And you know, I see a scenario where maybe you do get a recession coming and you could possibly see equities catch a bid even during a recession.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, here's what I think, I just think this is kind of funny. This happens a lot with different people I talk to, different meetings I sit in on, and different analysts that I listen to, is they will talk a lot, especially equity guys. And when they talk about, you know, they'll talk about the earnings recession, and then they'll talk about the sky high valuations, right? And that's fine. And then we switch over to the fixed income market, and people talk about negative yields, and they'll, God, we got $15 trillion of negative yields, and everybody kind of laughs about it, right?
Yeah.
But negative yields are essentially sky-high valuations in bonds.
That's right.
Right?
Yep.
How come we don't have constant discussions about the high valuation of bonds? Now, it's very possible that that high valuation is deserved, right? I'm not going to – like I said, I have friends that have extremely well thought out and good arguments of why the high valuation of bonds is deserved right now. But if you don't think that the valuation of bonds is, you know, standard of deviation higher than its typical norm – I mean, the standard valuation of bonds, the valuation of bonds relative to history is much higher than the valuation of equities versus history.
No question.
So, I mean, again, where are you going to allocate your money? Now, if you have enough money and you don't have to play, you think all these markets are ridiculous, so you don't want to play, then that's fine. I get it. Just go sit on the sidelines and wait for this all to come down, because it's going to. But, you know, my job doesn't allow me to just sit on the sidelines and do absolutely nothing. Now, I can sit on sidelines for short periods of time, and I can do some relative trades, and I can put some hedges on, and I can hold cash in the portfolio. But there's a lot of – and that's me. But they're pension fund managers, they can't go to cash.
No.
You know, and endowment managers, they can't go to cash. Mutual fund managers, they can't go to cash. So if you're going to – if you are choosing not to play in the game, I completely get it. But if you are choosing to play in the game, then it becomes a common knowledge game. And the common knowledge game is figuring out what everybody else is going to do. It doesn't really matter what you do. It matters what everybody else does. And I think everybody else, for better or for worse, will allocate more to the United States and to equities than they will to the rest of the world. And so, you know, that's my story, and I'm sticking to it.
No, and I'm right with you, man. And I really don't think that there's nearly as much choice in that as a lot of people think. You know, for instance, you know, you might think I'm crazy to be buying some of the dividend paying stocks that we're buying at 10, 11, 12 PEs, or shoot, even as high as 16, 17, 18 PEs, 20 PEs. Mm-hmm. You know, and you may or may not be right, but you know, I'm sitting there watching you as for a safety bid. You're jumping into a diversified sovereign debt portfolio where, you know, 60% of the issues inside of it have a negative yield, and you're concerned about me paying too much for it. You know, what do you even call?
I guess that's my point. That's exactly my point, right? Yeah. And, you know, again, if the value, I think if as an investor, valuations right now are giving you heartburn, you know, heaven help you over the next couple of years, because I think valuations are going to get even higher.
Well, I'm going to get some Imodium AD then, man, because they are giving me heartburn. But I keep citing, I just keep coming back to that whole idea of, you know, what we talked about the first time we had you on, where, yeah, look, the classic investor in me is just is wrestling with this whole valuation on a daily basis, because they are extreme, but they're nowhere close to as extreme as bonds. And to me, that is the that's the ground zero. Well, anyway, hey Brent, before we let you go though, how do the folks follow you? I know they can follow you on Twitter, which I'd strongly recommend it, at Santiago AU Fund. Where else can they follow you and get more of your ideas and your work?
You know, I'm on Real Vision quite often. I have another interview coming up there. I do a number of podcasts similar to yours. You know, I speak at various conferences from time to time, and anybody's welcome to email me. You can email me brent@santiagocapital.com. I try to answer everybody. Sometimes I fail. If you send me an email and I don't respond within a day or so, feel free to remind me. I'll do my best. I can't always help everybody, but I always try.
Yeah, there you go. Well, and you might be on a lot of other shows like ours, but you would admit that there's none exactly like ours, right? I mean, this is...
Well, there's no show like yours, Zach. Everybody should listen to your show.
Attaboy. Hey, Brent, I can't tell you thank you enough. Thanks for taking the time to come and talk to us and our listeners, and we'll be checking in with you and watching closely all your other appearances, and nothing but the best of luck to you, pal.